Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. And a Merry Christmas to those of you who celebrate the day. I really love this time of year. But also, within my soul, there is a crotchety old lady who's raising a wizened old fist against the fact that these days, the success of the season is measured in dollars, in retail revenues, in the consumption of stuff. So today, we're going to do something different. We're going to celebrate the creation of things. We are going to celebrate craft, the art of making things with your own two hands. Because craft is about beauty. It's about struggle. It's about slowing down time. Craft is about paying attention. So let's begin with Jana Melmud-Smith. The Cambridge writer and psychotherapist is daughter of the Pulitzer Prize-winning writer Bernard Melmud. And back in 2012, she wrote a beautiful book titled An Absorbing Errand, How Artists and Craftsmen Make Their Way to Mastery. And in it, she observes the following. Life is better when you possess a sustaining practice that holds your desire, demands your attention, and requires effort. Something that gratifies the wish to labor and create. Jana Melmud-Smith spoke with my former co-host Anthony Brooks. Here's how their conversation began.
So this book is so full of wisdom and insight and beautifully written about the creative process and about why so many people get blocked from expressing their creative side. And I wanted to start at the beginning of the book where you start. You write that life is better when you possess a sustaining practice that holds your desire, demands your attention, and requires effort. And you start with this great story, description of your late mother-in-law and her garden.
That's right.
So tell me about that. What did the garden mean to her?
Well, my mother-in-law was a very content person, except after a while I realized that in February she was no longer content. Or when the snow got high and she couldn't get into her garden, she'd get kind of irritable. And I once made the mistake of suggesting Prozac, but it turned out that not only was I way over the line, but all she had to do to feel better was to get back into her garden, because for her it was such a source of creative satisfaction. And one of the things that she really taught me by watching her there, that the important things in life are never totally mastered. They're always works in progress. Mm-hmm. They're always about staying with the thing for the love of the thing. And, of course, you also love the flowers you get. But it's really about being devoted and finding a way to stay with having your hands in the dirt.
And it can be having your hands in the dirt. It can be writing a piece of literature. It can be painting a picture. It can be all manner of things. But explain the title, An Absorbing Errand. It comes from a character in the novel Roderick Hudson by Henry James. Right?
That's right. It's a wonderful quotation. Essentially, the character says, look, we're told that to be truly happy, we have to get outside of ourselves. But then he thinks about it and he says, you know, it's not enough to get outside. In order to really be happy, you have to stay outside. Mm. And to stay outside, you have to have an absorbing errand. Mm. And I always thought it was sort of a contradictory statement, because if you're interested in art or weaving or any kind of craft or art, you know, you get inside yourself a lot. But the part that seems so true to me is that by having something you love to do, it gives you this whole new threshold, this whole new way of looking at the world, where suddenly everything is relevant to what you're trying to do. So if you're a woodworker, all of a sudden every single tree on your street has new meaning to you, because you're thinking about what the grain might look like when you turn it into a bow or a musical instrument or a table or something like that. So too, I remember a carpenter I wrote about a little bit in the book whose wife kind of dragged him off to England, and he really didn't want to go. But when they got there, they went to see some of the Christopher Wren churches, and he was just ecstatic because he could see how the churches had been put together. And here was his life's work in carpentry being sort of reflected back to him from somebody 400 years earlier who had had his own ideas about how things came together. So it allowed him to love being in England in a way that he wasn't prepared to do.
So let me ask you about you, because in your mother-in-law's case, it was the garden. For you, you're a psychotherapist, but it's also been your work as a writer. But you make the point that while writing provides you with a route to happiness. As you write, it also makes you dyspeptic and dispirited. It's difficult work. It's hard to stay with it, right?
It's difficult work. And I think one of my many gripes against sort of the happiness research that is flooding our culture and maybe drowning our culture is that it conveys this idea that happy should be like smiling faces and cheerful all the time. And what I'm much more interested in is the kind of satisfaction that comes from what I would call sort of meaning-making in your life, mm-hmm. from doing something that really feels meaningful to you. And I've had the good fortune to love doing psychotherapy, and I worked in the housing projects in Cambridge for about 15 years, and that was incredibly meaningful to me. But writing is also, and they're different, but they're similar because they're both crafts. They both, you could spend a lifetime getting better at them and never really be satisfied with how well you do them. You're always having to learn, and you get from that a sense on the good days of well-being, and on the bad days, a request that everybody around you hide the sharps.
And your book, and you spend a good deal of time in the book sort of exploring what blocks people from staying seated at their desk and doing the writing or picking up that paintbrush or becoming the craftsman that they might truly want to be. You write, Jana, that a big reason people give up mastering art, making, or complex craft is that they believe that the disheartening sensation they encounter are uniquely theirs, when in fact this is sort of part and parcel of becoming an artist.
Absolutely. I mean, it's sort of like if you were walking through a territory and came to a swamp, you would believe that you were the only person who was confronted with a swamp. And so what I'm trying to do in the book is to give people a sense of how universal or certainly widely shared a lot of the obstacles are. You know, everybody laughs and jokes about the 800 different critical voices that a second at your writing desk or your painting easel can bring up in you. Just the varieties of discouragement are, you know, like as many flowers as there are in the world. And what I try to do is to sort of join my readers as a companion, to kind of stay with them through it in the way that I write the book, and to just keep naming with them some of the things that other people have noticed about these encounters. And so, for example, if you find that all of a sudden just the prospect of beginning to a new work is making you so anxious that you can't stand to face it, I just want people to understand that's a very widely shared experience, and that isn't a reason to stop.
And push through it. And you use the analogy, you call it a cliche in the book, but I think it's a very good analogy. You use the analogy of going for a run and just feeling sort of sluggish on a particular day, or maybe 7 days in a row, maybe a week, and then one day, boom, something happens. You feel like you're as light as a feather and just charging along.
That's right. And, you know, it's that wonderful quotation of, I think it's Jack Nicklaus who says, the more I practice, the luckier I get. Yeah. I mean, it seems as if our brains work that way, too, that the more we stay with something, the more we show up at our desk day after day or a few times a week, the more we try, the more our brains really want to help us succeed. And I think that, you know, this idea of sort of creativity as a show of fireworks that is just so beautiful and fills the sky misses the point, which is that energy has to be captured and carried into the final work that we want to make.
Mm. So interesting. Jana, one of the things you write about that blocks people is, you call it shame in the book, and it opens up a whole interesting conversation about where people get blocked, one of the things that blocks people. Why shame? Talk about how shame sort of plays a role here.
Sure. I mean, shame, you know, everybody who's listening knows something about shame, though a lot of the time that it tackles us, we don't instantly recognize it as shame. We just feel like we want to crawl under the bed, suck our thumb, pull the shades, and never be seen by anybody else. And really what shame is about is it's a really, really, really unpleasant internal feeling that the people, the eyes that are looking at you, have found you to be either pathetic or wanting or inadequate
or a fraud.
Yeah. Or, you know, just a poor excuse for whatever it is that you were claiming that you wanted to do. So shame is a huge stopper in the world of creative mastery. People just get caught in it. And I think sometimes they don't even know what's hit them before it stops them in their tracks. What I also say in that chapter and in each chapter is not only can something like shame stop you, but it can also, shame is also one of the most profound engines of art making and of really trying to create things that are beautiful or that are accomplished, because we want to turn that feeling around. And I use as my primary example in that chapter Charlie Chaplin, who had this just awful growing up where he was shamed over and over and over again by everything. You know, he lived in the poorhouse, his parents had a tough time, et cetera, et cetera. Everybody made fun of him. And he took those shameful experiences and turned them into the best comedy we had in the whole 20th century. And what's so wonderful in the Chaplin movies is all of these things that would shame you and me in everyday life don't shame the Chaplin character.
Mm-hmm. Another example that you write about nicely is Julia Child and what she did to sort of turn around her feelings of inadequacy as she embarked on this journey that seemed daunting at the beginning to become a great master chef. Right?
Right. And, I mean, part of what Julia Child had was maybe the world's best work ethic, if we can believe the movie portrayals of cutting all those onions. But the great thing about Julia Child that I think made her capture such a huge audience is, once again, just when you thought she probably should die of shame when she drops the pot roast on the floor, she just picks it up, puts it back on, and says, the guests never come into the kitchen. You don't need to worry. And so that by doing that, she sort of makes you feel like you don't have to be embarrassed by what you cook either. Mm. And that is a wonderful thing.
What about these practical concerns? I mean, people have to work to make a living. And if they have a sort of tangential sort of artistic pursuit, they might say, I have no time. It doesn't pay. I can't afford it. These are obstacles as well.
They're huge, and I think they're very real in our culture. You know, I think that we've sort of smashed time in a way, probably partly from globalization, a bunch of reasons, so that so many people have to run as fast as they can to stay in just where they were economically or to do a little worse. And I really get that. I think, though, that sometimes that sense, I have no time, has another meaning, which is that I just don't believe in the possibility of myself doing what I want to do enough to make those little cracks, those little interstices in time that might let me actually work slowly on something.
Let me come back to you, because you have such an interesting story, and I don't know if had to overcome is the right word. Maybe I'm overstating it, but you're the daughter of Bernard Malamud, famous writer. How did that inform your desire to be a writer and maybe even challenge you?
Well, the good part about it is that I grew up watching somebody work really, really hard. My father not only had a full-time teaching job when I was a little kid, but he also wrote 3 or 4 days a week. And so he was working 7 days a week. And when I got to, I don't know, young adulthood, somebody told me that my father had died, and they'd been in the Library of Congress, and they had seen 19 copies of one draft of one short story. And I think that what that told me, it taught me, even more than just by watching him, was, oh, my God, that's what it means to stay with something, to be really good at it. So it was just sort of a model of how you persevere. He also said that he felt in his own life it was 10% talent and 90% effort that got him where he was. And, you know, he had been a really poor kid in a really tough time with a lot of family troubles, and he had pulled himself through it. So he was a model in those ways. I think probably the challenge was learning to be a lamp next to the sun, and learning that probably whatever you could do, it was going to be a tough act to follow.
Tough act to follow. Well, you did it. You did it pretty well. This idea, though, 10% talent, 90% effort. One of the things that tells me, and I think you make the point in the book as well, that so much of the sort of self-actualization of creating art comes through the process as much as it does through actually coming up with a finished product.
That's absolutely true. And I think that one of the reasons we're so excited about creativity in the culture, a little overheated, I think, is that we have so much anomie, so many people who just feel that nobody knows they exist. Mm. And so there's a lot of fantasy that if only I could become the world's best rock musician, or I could make the write a film script or make a movie or some one of those things. And I have so much sympathy for that. But the fantasy is that would make me someone. And what that fantasy skips is that that's a 20-year effort probably. I mean, if you're lucky, it's 5 years, but to begin to get good at something. But, you know, if you just focus on that finished product, you really are going to be disappointed all the time. Because for most of us, no matter how much we love what we do, we're going to be in small venues. We're going to be people who have small audiences. And if you can't delight and love what you're doing, then you're always going to end up wondering why you've spent your time that way.
Jana Malmud-Smith, author of An Absorbing Errand, How Artists and Craftsmen Make Their Way to Mastery. She spoke with Anthony Brooks in 2012.